Chapter 3. Unusual Ascension.
"My thinking's not changed. 4,000 are needed," Brunner explained late that year of 1485 DR.
Outside, winter was on in full, but in Mithril Hall all seemed cozier than it had in many a year. The tunnels to Felbar and Adbar were secured, and couriers moved between the three dwarven fortresses on a regular basis, with every new dispatch bringing news of growing excitement for the march to Gontalgrim. The threat of the orcs felt far removed now.
"Might be more than that," King Conorad remarked. "Harnoth's had his griping, but Erethio's spike's been there every hour, whispering in his ear. Now the young king's thinking that Adbar's best served by bringing the biggest force to Gontalgrim.
Might be that he's got his eyes on the throne," General Dagnabbit chimed in.
"That ain't for happening," said Brunner. "But let the hungry young one think what he's thinking if it's getting me the warriors I need. If Gontalgrim's all ye say, then might be harder to keep the three citadels of the Silver Marches open and manned," King Conorad said, with something in his tone that gave Brunner pause, and not for the first time over these 10 days of anticipation.
Brunner looked to Drizzt, who nodded, obviously catching the other king's demeanor as well.
"So when are you meaning to speak it clear, me friend?" Brunner asked pointedly.
Conorad looked at him with puzzlement.
"I'm knowing your heart, young Braunanvil," said Brunner, "as I knowed your da's, as I'm knowing me own."
By that point, all eyes were squarely focused on the young King Conorad.
"Ye ain't getting Gontalgrim's throne," said Brunner.
"Not wanting it,"
Conorad replied.
"But,"
Drizzt prompted. Conorad sighed, snorted, and said nothing.
"But you're wanting to go," said Brunner.
Conorad snorted again, as if the mere suggestion was preposterous. But Brunner never blinked, and his probing expression would not let go of Conorad.
"Aye,"
the young king finally admitted.
"Ye got Mithril Hall," Brunner replied. "We been through it, lad. I ain't for taking that from ye."
"Been all me life here in the hall," said Conorad.
And with that, Brunner nodded his agreement.
"With half that life having your arse on the throne," said Brunner. "Weighing on ye, is it?" "Aye, I know, lad."
"Weighed on your own arse when ye left," said Dagnabbit,
and there was an unmistakable edge in her voice that gave Brunner and some others pause.
"Sure in that you're not for thinking that King Brunner owed the hall more," Conorad scolded the general.
"Never said that,"
she replied.
"Then what?" "Aye," Brunner agreed. "What?"
General Dagnabbit swallowed hard, her deep breath showing that she was at a crossroads and trying to find her heart.
"Was me grandfather that chased the grey dwarfs from Mithril Hall?" she said. "Was me grandfather and me da that readied the throne for King Brunner's return from Calimport, and was them that served well aside ye?"
"Aye, as was me own da,"
Conorad Braunanvil said.
"Served King Brunner and the king afore him."
"Aye, and your legacy's no greater than me own,"
General Dagnabbit blurted, drawing gasps from everyone else.
"Careful, lass. He's your king,"
Bungalow Thump warned.
"Me king who's wanting to leave, he just said," Dagnabbit pressed. "As yourself's leaving to serve as Brunner's shield."
Off to the side, Caddybreed chuckled, and when Brunner looked from Dagnabbit to his adopted daughter, he noted Caddybreed nodding in approval to Dagnabbit.
"What are you saying, girl?"
Brunner demanded of the young but capable general.
"Just speak it."
"Me own claim on Mithril Hall's throne's no less than Conorad's, except that ye give the throne to his da, Bainak," she said bluntly.
Bungalow Thump wailed, but Conorad calmed him with an upraised hand.
"And I'm not doubting your pick of Bainak, as me own da and grand-da were dead under the stones."
"But,"
Drizzt prompted again.
"But me friend's not thinking Mithril Hall's needing a steward on her throne when I'm aside ye on the road to Gontalgrim, King Brunner,"
Conorad explained. She's thinking Mithril Hall's needing a queen.
Brunner stared hard at General Dagnabbit, who matched his look without blinking, not backing away a finger's breadth from the accusation.
Throne's not me own to give, he said at length,
and both turned to Conorad.
Queen Dagnabbit,
the young Braun Anvil mused aloud, and he chuckled and nodded. He and Dagnabbit had been dear friends for all their lives, military nobility in Mithril Hall's proud ranks. He turned to Brunner.
She's speaking truly, he admitted. None are more distinguished, none more deserving. If me own father had been killed to death in the Obuld War, who'd Brunner have chosen? Meself or Dagnabbit?
Brunner shrugged, not willing to go there.
If ye'd choose meself, then me friend Dagnabbit would serve ye well as she served me well, said Conorad. And if ye'd choose to make a queen Dagnabbit, then no, she'd have had no more loyal friend and general than meself.
And now you're leaving, said Brunner.
He turned to Dagnabbit.
And yourself staying?
Then Queen Dagnabbit,
Conorad said to Brunner, and he wasn't asking, for in truth it wasn't Brunner's or anyone else's place to offer an opinion. Succession was the choice of the king of Mithril Hall, and Conorad was the king of Mithril Hall.
Are ye asking or telling?
Brunner did reply.
Both. Then I and I, said Brunner. Queen Dagnabbit!
Bungalow Thump shouted, and the huzzas and hey-hos filled the audience chamber and exploded out to echo down the corridors of Mithril Hall. Dagnabbit bowed respectfully, then stood up straight, seeming hardly shaken and looking every bit the ferocious leader of Mithril Hall.
"Me first request's an easy one,"
she said to both Conorad and Brunner. She smiled and turned to Bungalow Thump.
"Once ye get done chasing the drow from Gontalgrim, ye give me back me Bungalow Thump. Mithril Hall's not to be without him."
"Honored, me king,"
Bungalow said, punching his fists together. It took him a while to realize why everyone in the room was staring at him then, and with expressions full of amusement.
"Honored, me queen,"
the embarrassed gutbuster corrected, and Dagnabbit led the ensuing laughter. When the Council of the Three Dwarven Citadels convened in Citadel Felbar in the second month of 1486, Queen Dagnabbit was announced formally as the ruler of Mithril Hall, and King Conorad, now shield general of Brunner's impending march, did not even make the trip to Felbar, busy as he was organizing the warriors Mithril Hall would send to the west. King Harnoff seemed stupefied by the action, incredulous that any dwarf would surrender a throne, perhaps. He was young, Brunner knew, and still a novice in the ways of being a king. The burdens would weigh on him in another century, likely, if he managed to stay alive that long, something of which Brunner could not be certain, given Harnoff's recklessness in the war and his stubbornness subsequently. King Emerus, though, not only seemed less than surprised, his nod was one of approval. A few moments later, when Emerus announced that he too would be abdicating his throne to join with his old friend Brunner in the march to Gontalgrim, the chorus of gasps were not enhanced by Brunner.
"What am I hearing?"
Harnoff cried in disbelief and clear dismay. "That you are now the longest-serving dwarf king of the Silver Marches," said Drizzt.
"Madness!"
Harnoff fumed, and he slammed his fist down on the table.
"All me life! Me das speak to King Brunner and King Emerus, and now you're both for leaving? We won the war and all the lands scarred, and now you're leaving?"
"Scars I'll heal,"
Emerus said solemnly, his resonant voice showing that he wasn't taking this lightly.
"With or without meself and Brunner and Conorad. Felbar's got her succession as Mithril Hall's got hers."
He leaned forward and looked down the length of the long table. And Parson Glaive nodded, showing his king, who was now his subject, great deference.
"Citadel Felbar is mine,"
the high cleric announced.
"Huzzah to King Parson Glaive of Felbar,"
Emerus toasted, rising up and lifting his flagon.
"Huzzah," all replied.
And huzzah, Queen Dagnabba to Mithril Hall! Brunner cheered, and the boisterous shouts filled the hall once more. Brunner looked to Amaris and nodded, sincerely thrilled and grateful that his old and respected friend would be accompanying him on the journey to reclaim the most ancient Delzoon homeland.
"Mithril Hall on the first day of spring," Ragged Dane added. "And let the ground shake under the fall of 4,000 dwarf boots."
8,000, ye dolt,
Brunner corrected, hoisting his flagon so forcefully that half of the contents splashed out.
"Most have got two legs." "Huzzah," they cheered.
"I should destroy you for coming here,"
the great white worm roared.
"You should reconsider your dangerous impulses," came a calm reply, and it was a sincere response from an archmage who had lived closer to 2 centuries than one, and who had come to the lair of Arothiter, the old white death, fully prepared to survive a dragon's onslaught.
"The attempts to bring Tiamat to the prime material plane have failed, and so I understand your frustrations, Great Worm," Grumpf added. "But so too has Loth failed in her quest for the domain of magic. These are the provinces of the gods, and we can do that which we may and little more. The world goes on, as does Arothiter, as do I."
"The philosophy of a weakling," the dragon replied. "To so dismiss failure."
"To so dwell upon it when time moves forward," said Grumpf with a tisk-tisk and a shake of his head.
"You mock me."
"I only mock those I consider pathetic," the archmage answered. "I have never thought that of you, surely."
"The world goes on without my son," said the dragon.
"Do you pretend to care? I know enough of your kind and of you to believe that such a claim is one of false appeal." The dragon chuckled, a low and rumbling sound that sounded as if a prelude to an earthquake, and, Grumpf knew, often was.
"You were rewarded well for your efforts in the war," Grumpf reminded the worm. "The treasures from Sundabar alone." He let the thought hang in the air and shook his head.
"Then let us put that which is past behind us," the worm agreed. "So why are you here in this my home?"
"You were not alone in your last battle of the war," Grumpf explained. "Nor was your son. We have found the body of the noble drow killed with Orbengross."
"But not that of your impetuous and impudent nephew," the dragon commented.
"Tiago, yes," Grumpf agreed. "A favored noble of the matron mother Beenri, though one who has grown tiresome to me."
"He is not digested?"
Grumpf asked dryly. The dragon paused and spent a moment letting the quip register before offering an amused, rumbling chuckle in response.
"It is an honest question," the archmage said. "He is not here. Nor has he been in my presence since the battle above the Cerbrin Bridge," the dragon replied.
"A battle in which he rode astride you?"
"Yes. A battle from which you flew directly home?"
"Yes."
"Must I follow all the possibilities?" "Tiago was shot from my back in the fight, by a drow no less, with a bow that spat arrows of lightning."
Grumpf took a deep breath, drizzed again.
"Drizzt slayed him in the midst of an aerial battle."
"I did not say that. You said—" Grumpf stopped and silently recounted the dragon's exact words.
"The clever archer shot the cinch from the saddle, and so Tiago fell from his seat," the dragon explained. "We were up by the roiling blackness of Loth's inspired spell, and so miles above the ground. You might search the lower ground north of the dwarven stronghold to see if you can locate a drow-shaped splatter upon the ground."
Grumpf nodded, though he was hardly listening, playing it all out in his thoughts.
He, of course, knew of the magical House Beanry emblems, which could impart near weightlessness with but a touch. So perhaps Tiago was not dead, and was down there still, and likely still hunting Drizzt. "He is such a fool," the Archmage muttered under his breath, but not enough so to keep the words from the keen hearing of an ancient white dragon.
"Which?" Arothedur asked. "The archer or your nephew? Or are you perhaps speaking of me, in which case I find that I am suddenly hungry?"
"Dragon, you bore me," Gromph said and waved his hand. With that movement, mighty Arothedur sprang to the attack, the great worm's serpentine neck sweeping forward, the toothy maw snapping over Gromph. Or the projected image of Gromph. For the Archmage was far from that place, and farther still when the dragon's killing jaws snapped, teleporting away almost instantly and leaving Arothedur defensively crouched and growling.
"They will leave on the first day of spring," Doomwheel told Tiago. "You are certain?"
Doomwheel answered him with a stare. She wiped the mud and makeup from her face and began to unbraid her hair. She couldn't travel about the region without some minor disguise. Some might well recognize her as the daughter of Cynophane.
"The dwarves are all chattering about it," she explained. "They're thick about the wall they have constructed near to where Dark Arrow Keep once stood, convinced that Lorgru will return."
"And will he?" Doomwheel shrugged.
"You should be more thorough in your scouting, Iblith," Tiago scolded.
"And I should kill you while you sleep," Doomwheel wanted to reply, but did not.
"There has been no sign of the orcs since Brunner sent them running," she answered. "Even those dwarves skeptical about this march to the west have come to believe that it will be a good thing."
"And what is in the west that is so enticing them?" Tiago remarked, walking out to the northeastern edge of the encampment, looking out at the campfires dotting the distant hills.
"Does it matter?"
Tiago spun around, his expression sharp.
"How long do you intend to play this game, Tiago?"
The drow inhaled, nostrils flaring, Doomwheel thought, as if he meant to leap upon her and throttle her.
"Duke, Tiago,"
she obediently corrected, and she lowered her gaze.
"Drizzt will be with them," Doomwheel said. "And the woman, Catti Bree. Do not underestimate her. They whisper that she is a chosen of Mialiki, and her magical powers, both arcane and divine, are considerable."
"Then she can properly consecrate Drizzt's grave," Tiago said, turning back to the campfires, "even without his head."
"Indeed," Kazideya said in Doomwheel's mind, and the woman chuckled.
Tiago spun back again.
"You doubt me?"
he said with a growl. "The thought of a headless Drizzt amuses me," Doomwheel said, and she wasn't lying.
"And you will amuse me,"
Tiago said and started for her.
"Now."
Doomwheel lowered her gaze once more, and when Tiago pushed her down to the bedroll, she did not resist.
"Patience,"
her magical sword told her repeatedly throughout her ordeal. The long-plotting sentient weapon assuring her over and over again that she would get her revenge, but in a more profound and satisfying way. A short while later, it was Doomwheel's turn to linger at the northeastern edge of the firelight, looking out over the rolling hills to the campfires of the distant dwarven encampments. Despite her resolve to suppress her wistful nature, her thoughts drifted farther to the east, and inevitably out across the river. She loved the glimmer wood in the winter, when the pine branches bent low under the weight of new-fallen snow. She thought of sleigh rides she had taken along the paths between those trees, the heavy canopy creating an enchanting roof of bending branches and multiple skylights, the stars shining through to evoke wispy sparkles all about the snowpack. She heard the elf song in her mind, the many voices lifting to the starlit sky past the natural canopy, calling to the patterns of twinkling lights they had named for this creature or that. The rushing crayfish had ever been Doomwheel's favorite, with a cluster of bright stars outlining one huge claw, dimmer stars showing the second as a smaller outline,
as if the astral creature was reaching forward with that one claw, beckoning. And it was a call Doomwheel wanted to answer then and now. Her eyes drifted up to the heavens, to a million, million stars twinkling in the cold night. There were no stars in the Underdark, in Menzo Berenzon. It had its own beauty, surely, with a fairy fire liming the stalactites and stalagmites. But it didn't have stars. And the elves of Menzo Berenzon didn't lift their voices as one to the heavens. "Patience, little doe," the woman heard in her mind. Images of great glory and greater power filled her thoughts, and she lost sight of the stars above as surely as if a heavy cloud front had swept in and stolen the eternal mystery. 2 10 days later, Tiago and Doomwheel were awakened one bright morning by the sound of drums. Remembering the significance of this day, the pair rushed to a high vantage point on a steep-sided hillock and peered against the glare of the rising sun to the southeast. There marched the dwarves, under a banner of a living fire in humanoid form, its arms uplifted and holding a great anvil and throne. The leading troop crossed to the south of Tiago and Doomwheel's position, their line stretching far back with many pack mules heavily laden. And with a drow on a white unicorn trotting easily beside an auburn-haired woman astride a similar mount, but one that seemed made of the essence of light itself, spectral and sparkling. Doomwheel looked at Tiago, the drow fixated on the vision. His every dream marched in front of him. "Well, that was unnecessary," Jarlaxle quipped when Gromp warped into the room where he and Kimuriel waited. "You think me frivolous?" There was a decidedly deadpan tone to Gromp's voice, as if the words were simply a prelude to a storm. "Or foolish," Jarlaxle replied. "Why would you taunt an ancient worm?" "You think me weak?" Gromp asked, with that most sinister edge to his voice that he had perfected over the centuries. And the storm clouds seemed closer to Jarlaxle, and darker. "I think a dragon mighty and fear you underestimate, so now I am a fool," Jarlaxle sighed. "He knew that he could escape instantly," Kimuriel interjected, as he psionically imparted to Gromph. "Jarlaxle thinks it was truly you standing before the worm, and not merely a clever image. In that regard, you must admit that his concerns are valid. A dragon is, after all, a dragon." Gromph let his amusement flow back to the drow psionicist. "With the psionic teleport you have taught him," said Jarlaxle. "Taught?" Kimuriel replied. "That is not the correct word. I have opened possibilities. The Archmage has learned how to walk through those less than tangible doors." "It is not the first time I have used this new ability," Gromp reminded them. "I find it interesting. That you are able to concentrate so fully as to succeed speaks well of your discipline, Archmage," Kimuriel said with a bow. "I am impressed that one of your meager training has come so far. I wanted to see if I could perform the teleport under extreme duress," Grump said, his gaze darting back and forth at both of his companions, gauging their reactions. "Well played, then," said Jarlaxle. "You heard my conversation with the worm?" Jarlaxle nodded. "Tiago is almost certainly alive. Find him." "I would hope to find his body. For that task, I would actually, well, search," said Jarlaxle. "It was not a request," Gromph said. "Find Tiago. Put out your scouts, all of them. Tiago is alive and in the north. Find him." "So that you can retrieve him for Quenthal and all will be forgiven?" Jarlaxle dared to reply. "And will you then betray my actions to our sister brother to better your own prospects in her court?" He expected a tirade, of course, but surprisingly, Gromph did not react angrily. "I'm not going to betray you for your role in bringing the copper worms to the fight," he said. "Not yet.
But I warn you, do not give me reason to do so. I know what you did. Brother, never forget that.
Gromp paused and sighed, then said,
I go.
And he did, instantly disappearing from the room.
A strange encounter, Jarlaxle remarked.
Both of the Archmage's encounters this day, I agree, said Kimuriel.
There is a sadness to Gromp, said Jarlaxle.
Loth lost her quest for the domain of magic.
Worse had she won. Gromp now understands that the benefit would have been reserved for the matron mothers and their female proteges. He stands at the pillar of his power, and knows that is not so high a tower in the City of Spiders.
Kimuriel shrugged as if it did not matter, and Jarlaxle smiled knowingly. Kimuriel, after all, didn't seem to measure his worth by such metrics. His reward was knowledge alone, as far as Jarlaxle could decipher.
The Archmage will find his way, was all Kimuriel said, and he started for the exit from the cavern Bregendierth had taken as a base in the Silver Marches.
It wasn't him, Jarlaxle said, stopping Kimuriel cold just a couple of strides from the corridor. The psionicist slowly turned to regard the grinning mercenary.
Standing before the dragon, Jarlaxle explained. Do you think so little of me as to believe that I would be fooled by a magical illusion, a projected image?
Kimuriel started to respond, but bit it back, and Jarlaxle smiled knowingly, quite pleased that his psionicist friend was clearly realizing the context of his remarks. After all, Kimuriel had only made the demeaning quip concerning Jarlaxle telepathically to Gromp. And Kimuriel had no reason at all to believe that Jarlaxle could so eavesdrop on a psionic communication. Which, of course, Jarlaxle could not. He had merely guessed regarding Kimuriel's silent interactions with the Archmage. But now, of course, given Kimuriel's reaction, Jarlaxle knew that his guess had hit the mark.
How many of our scouts will you need to find Tiago?
A shaken Kimuriel asked, trying to change the subject.
Just you, Jarlaxle replied,
and the psionicist cocked an eyebrow suspiciously.
If Tiago is alive, then he's after Drizzt, and so will not be far afield of Brunner's March, Jarlaxle explained. I have Athrogate and Amber already in place among Brunner's entourage. Use your psionic energies to see through the eyes of those the dwarves march past, and we will find Tiago. And so you can deliver to Gromp that which he desires.
Kimuriel nodded and left, and Jarlaxle leaned back against the wall, considering the whole of that encounter. Something was going on that was beyond his understanding. Something with Kimuriel, probably perpetrated by Kimuriel, and likely involving Gromp. He wasn't afraid that Kimuriel was trying to be rid of him to claim sole leadership of Bregendierth. Quite the contrary. Kimuriel wanted Jarlaxle around so he did not have to assume the mundane burdens of such a role. No, it was something else, Jarlaxle figured. Something extraneous to him, something beyond the scope of and purview of Bregendierth, even.
Seven dwarves led the vast procession of the Silver March's army from the Cerberan Bridge, marching in ranks of two, three, and two. King Brunner Battlehammer centered the leading formation in the second rank, flanked by Bungalow Thump and Conorad Braunanvil, with Amber Grisolo Maul and Athrogate close behind as his personal bodyguards. Two other bodyguards had joined Brunner's personal entourage at the beginning of the march, gifts given to him by King Emerus Warcrown in his last declaration as leader of Citadel Felbar. And to be sure, the dwarf lasses Fist and Fury, Malabriches and Tanabriches Fellhammer, could not have been more thrilled at their permanent assignment, especially when their old friend Brunner positioned them right in front of him. Right in front of all of them, leading the march.